You know, I didn't originally plan to come to Georgia. You know, you see all this gray hair I got? You know, it still looks good, you said? All right. I'll let Michelle know. But the reason I'm here, after my last campaign in 2012, I thought, all right, you know, I'll campaign in 16, and then I'll just kind of go off and, you know, write my book and work on my golf game and spend a little more time with my wife. Things didn't work out the way we expected because we weren't focused. Each one of us didn't do everything we needed to do. And so in this election, when I got a call and said, look, Georgia could be the state. Georgia could be the place where we put this country back on track, and not just because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have a chance to win Georgia, but you've got the chance to flip two Senate seats. I said, well, I got to go. I got to come. I told Michelle, I'm sorry, baby. I got to go to Georgia. This is a big deal. You have two extraordinary candidates in John and the Reverend who deserve your vote. And let's face it, you've also got two senators who badly need to be replaced.
First things, David, for November 17th, Barack Obama.
Barack Obama in Georgia is the focus of this one. So we know that Georgia is the center of the political universe for a couple different reasons right now. And Barack Obama, that is him, of course, speaking in Georgia, outside of Atlanta, on the day before the election, November 2nd, Monday, November 2nd, him speaking. And he was sent there by the Biden campaign right as a last minute thing. You deploy a very powerful surrogate, like a former president, a very popular former president, carefully. And they sent him to Florida a couple times because they were trying to really improve their standing among Latinx voters. And they sent him to Michigan, and they sent him to Georgia. Those are the states. Oh, I'm sorry. He also went to Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. Those four states were the states that he went and campaigned for Biden and Harris. So he went there on the day before the election to try to get Georgia across the finish line. And it happened. It did it. They did it. So I want to talk a little bit about the strategy of Obama going to Georgia, what it tells us about Biden and Harris and the Democrats there, and also pay a little attention to what he had to say in those words. It's about a 15-minute speech, and that is that's about 2 minutes of it. And the whole speech, he's just so good as a campaigner. I mean, he just thrives in that space, and he is delivering it without notes. He's just delivering it from memory, and he hits these points about what Biden Harris would do and what Trump has done. And then he moves on to the Senate races and talks about those. He's just so knowledgeable and also relatable. So the fact that Obama went or was asked to go and then went to Georgia tells us how dialed in to the data the Biden and Harris campaign was. When you looked at the states that the Biden-Harris campaign had identified early in 2020, once he became the nominee, it identified as the key states. They were doing presentations via Zoom to donors, to supporters. And so they shared their map. And their map has 16 key states on it. And three of them were what you would call, I think they called expand states. States where they were hoping to expand the map to places that the Dems had not won, maybe in many, many decades. And the three expand states were Georgia, Texas, and Arizona. They won two of them by really narrow margins, but they got it. They got it done. And so late in the campaign, when it became apparent that Georgia was a possibility, there was an advice. The campaign began to send folks there. So they sent Harris there twice. Biden himself made a visit on October 27th, went to Warm Springs, where Franklin Roosevelt had gone, as a kind of like a southern White House. And Biden also spoke in Atlanta. And then on November 1st, Harris came back. And on November 2nd, Obama came. And there's this great political article that talked about Georgia. And the article came out on the 1st when Harris was there and the day before Obama came. And that political article cited a source, a Democratic source in Georgia, who said, look, we know this is for real. We know that we can do this. We can flip the state. And they said, you know how we know? Because he said, we've gone from Doug to Obama. And what he was talking about, he said, is that there's a 5-point scale that organizers use to assess the seriousness of the Biden-Harris campaign. And the 5-point scale is about which surrogate you get to visit you, which people come to visit you and campaign there. And Doug was the lowest point on this. And that's Doug Emhoff, who is Kamala Harris's husband. Then the next one up, the number two, is Jill Biden, Joe Biden's wife. Number three up was Vice President candidate Kamala Harris. Number four was Joe Biden. But he wasn't the top, even though he's the top, he was the candidate. Number five was Obama. He was the best that you could get. And this source said, we got Obama. We know it's for real. He's coming tomorrow. And that was a moment where the Georgians began to say, this is it. We can really get this done. And indeed, they did get it done, and he's going to win the state. They're going to win the state by 13,000 votes. So I really am pleased that the Biden-Harris campaign was that tuned in to where they were at in the votes in the state. That speaks well of their ability to kind of pay attention to the trends. So that's point one. I'll stop there to get your thoughts.
Well, I have a question. And I don't know if it's going to take too much time or not, but it's something I've always wondered, and you must have the data or at least the inklings of it. What's the evidence that these last minute appearances move enough voters to change the outcome?
Sure. There is some pretty good political science data that shows that the most kind of influential impacts upon voter votes and voter turnout are not advertisements that run in districts. And this is district level data in this research, congressional district level data. It's not advertisements. It is field offices, and it is candidate visits. And that those latter two pieces move the needle, not 10 points, but they move the needle at the margins around a percent or so.
And we're living
so
in a world
it does percent. Seem to matter.
We're living
exactly.
in a percent, so yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you need to lay the groundwork with the field offices in order for the appearances to matter, or are those unrelated?
Right. No, they are related for sure. They are related for sure. There's also the counter impact with Trump. We saw not in 2016, but in 17, 18, when he was not on the ballot, but he was the massive figure in our politics, that his appearances in districts had a double effect. It had an impact upon turnout of his supporters, and it also had an impact on Democratic turnout in a positive way, in a way that helped the Democrats. So, you know, those visits raise the salience of the campaign and give a shot of adrenaline to everybody there. And they also capture massive local media coverage, right? So folks like a Seattle Times, a KUOW, a Tacoma News Tribune would cover in depth a visit by Barack Obama on the day before the election. So all of the Atlanta media outlets gave this high attention. I was looking at the local news coverage, and they're, you know, inevitably that coverage tends to be pretty favorable because all they're doing is kind of on the scene reporting. That's what they're doing. Just like, oh, look, here's what he was here. Here's what he had to say. And those are, you know, that's always something pro-democratic, whatever he's got to say. So that it does seem to make a difference. Certainly campaigns use their people very, very resourcefully of where they should be. So Obama comes and they get across the finish line. It's already become clear that in Georgia, the most desired person for the next 7 weeks, we got 7 weeks till the special election is over, is Barack Obama still. It is Barack Obama. He's the most desired person. After that, Biden, but the gap between the two is fairly sizable, and Kamala Harris. And it does look like Biden will campaign in the state, and Harris most likely too, which is not a foregone conclusion for a person who's coming in as president to campaign for a Senate race just before they take over as president. A lot of times presidents don't want to come and kind of get into the partisan fray right when they're about to become president. In 2008, there was another Senate runoff, and Barack Obama did not come and campaign after winning the presidency, did not come and campaign for the Democratic candidate. And the Democratic candidate did lose. But Obama addresses that point in his speech. He talks about the difference between how close, how important these Senate races are to the governing ability of the Biden administration relative to that Senate race for his. And that's why he's there and it's so important. So Obama in Georgia was a sign. It was a catalyst. And it was an indicator of the sophistication of the Biden and Harris internal data program. There's another thing that I want to talk about, though, which is what Obama says in that minute and a half clip, which is he says, you know, I thought it was going to be this. My life was going to be this. And he's being, you know, in his usual way, a little bit funny, a little bit facetious, but always with a message, always with a point. That I thought my life was going to be this. I was going to write a book, which he's done. Thought I was going to play golf, spend more time with Michelle Obama. But he said, we didn't do all that we could. We didn't stay focused. And as a result, I'm here now and we're here now. And we can't let that happen again. So over and over and over again in Common Power, we talk about the importance of not just this election, but every election going forward. And many of us are not living, maybe all of us are not living the life at this moment that we would have imagined or hoped a few years ago or even 9 months ago. Because of COVID, because of our politics, because of the economy, because of just health challenges in this country, climate change. And so we all have to be doing what we are doing, which is living the life that we should be and need to be living here. Doing podcasts, doing our work in Georgia, all this stuff. And that there is like, the, it's hard, just to speak personally, it's hard to have that kind of hope gone, that you thought it was going to be this and now it's that. And the ability to respond and adapt in ways that are resilient and are ethical for the good of the world is what we're faced with as a country right now. Our ability to adapt and to change, to live the political, the civic life that we need to live in order to rebuild this democracy is a reality that is not going to change. There is no return to that hope, that desire, that dream of an undivided or a simple or a kind of a place where vacations are are easily taken without worries about our society or COVID. It just isn't going to happen. This is the world we live in. And that's what the hand that is dealt to us right now. And so when we read history books, whether it's about societies, America or otherwise, or it's about peoples, or it's about particular figures, this is where we're at. And the kind of ability for us to step forward as we have in this election, as we are in Georgia now, and as we are going forward, is what is defining to us. It is the defining piece of our time right now.
I would say that was sobering, but it's not. It's not sobering. It's fine. It is the defining piece, and it's been that way in one form or another. I mean, I guess my whole life, right? As the world fills up with people and the wild and the natural disappear. I mean, we are compelled to feel that. There's no rest for the weary, David.
There is no rest in the sense of which we, those of us who have had the life and the narrative that there would be rest. For us, that's the change, is that there isn't. For others who never really had that as a dream or a narrative, for them, this is just what it is. But for people who thought you get a job, you work, your health is good, and then you get these later years to do X, that isn't there. It isn't there. It isn't there at all in the same way that people would have thought. The choice is for us to lean into that and to embrace it and to say, this is what I'm here for. This is what I'm here for. Or to long for the world as we would like it. I certainly long occasionally for it, but it's usually like an hour or two as opposed to a year or two, right?
Yeah. Well, there's no real value in longing for very long because that doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, and we can chop this if we need to chop it later. Did you think that you were going to be teaching and doing all this stuff when you retired from KUW?
I wanted to do more. I wanted to, so I mean, maybe not a good answer. No, I wanted to do more. I'd still like to, I mean, I have this desire to go and teach and study in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. I still sort of envision a VISTA or a Peace Corps volunteer episode, though. I might be too creaky for them, but I don't think so. So
yeah,
envisioned retirement as being golf on a country club course and sipping Mai Tais, though I'll still sip the Mai Tais.
Sure. Right. So your conception from the beginning was there's another phase to my civic work.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And my personal work. I mean, you know, I wanted to be writing novels and have them get published, but I wanted them to be novels that were meaningful.
Yeah, I think that's all part of a broader civic contribution to the public arena, to the good of a people's and society. And I think that phase, that notion, that phase approach, that there are chapters, that's a better word, chapters, is the reality of life. Now in the United States, there are chapters, and this is the chapter for everybody of massive civic democratic engagement.
And that's okay, because there's lots of people all around the world who don't have that ability or privilege, or opportunity. So that's okay. And
exactly.
And the world is, it is a battle. It's a pitched battle. I don't mean it like, you know, pitchforks, though, maybe, but it is a pitched battle between different worldviews. And there is a worldview that I guess does embrace the idea of the Mai Tai at the country club and having other people around to clean up for them and stuff. But if we're the ones doing the cleaning up, I want other people to join in. That's my perception of the battle. Hey, I'm not doing this alone. Get over here and pick some of this up too, pal.
Right. That the collectivity, which battles hard against the individualism, It's not a socialism in this country that people are fighting for on the left. It's a collectivity. It's a sense that we're all in this together.
Yeah, we all get to make decisions on our own, but we do it with the idea of how it affects another person. Yeah, I mean, at the best of times.
Yep. So we all gotta be like Barack Obama right now and say either to ourselves or to others, I'm sorry, baby, because that's my favorite line he uses. I gotta go to Georgia. We may or may not literally go to Georgia, but we are remotely going to Georgia. So let's follow the lead of our ambassador, Barack Obama, number 5 on the campaign scale, and let's go.